This is Nachyomi, Sefer Melachim Bet, Chapter 12. Yehoash becomes king at the age of 7 years old, and he's directed by Yehoyada the Kohen. All the years that he benefited from the guidance of Yehoyada, he remains true to the path of Torah. The primary focus of Yehoyada's reign is the renovation of the neglected temple. He orders the Kohanim to collect funds from their friends and families for the purpose of this project. However, to his chagrin, they do not complete this assignment. Yehoash relieves the Kohanim of this responsibility and instead has a charity box installed in the temple. Money is deposited in the box by visitors to the Beit HaMikdash, and whenever it becomes filled to capacity, the money is removed and used to pay for supplies and labor that's necessary for repairing and improving the building. The men appointed to count and disperse the funds were not supervised by any government authorities, nor were formal records kept because the operations were conducted in good faith. Hazael, king of Aram, conquers Gat, and then moves to lay siege to Jerusalem. Yehoash empties the temple treasury of all the gold that he, his father, and his grandfather had consecrated to Hashem, as well as the gold stored in his palace, and he delivers it to Hazael to avoid a battle. Two of Yehoash's servants eventually conspire against him and assassinate him, and his son Amatziah rules in his stead. We can understand Yehoash's profound devotion to the Beit HaMikdash and his commitment to restoring it. After all, he was raised within its hallowed walls, and his entire education was delivered by the Kohanim, who ensured that he developed a deep understanding of its critical importance to the life of the Jewish people. Beyond this, Yehoash's efforts symbolize a return to the tradition of the House of David and his ancestors David and Shlomo, both of whom were supremely dedicated to the objective of creating a house of God that would represent his presence and his relationship with the Jewish people for all eternity. Yehoash seems like a fitting heir to the legacy of his distinguished forefathers. However, for reasons never explained in the text, Yehoash ultimately fails as a king, surrendering to Hazael, sacrificing the wealth of the temple and the kingdom to placate the enemy, and dying a violent death at the hand of treacherous assassins. How can we understand the dramatic reversal in Yehoash's fortune? Why did this righteous king fall before his enemies in such an ignoble manner? Sefer Melachim offers us no clear answer to these questions. In Sefer Divrei HaYamim, which was composed much later during the period of the Second Temple, we read of the spiritual decline of Yehoash after the death of Yehoyada, his teacher. Succumbing to the flattery of his officers, his enthusiasm for the temple wanes, and he allows idolatry to resurface in the kingdom. When he's publicly rebuked by the prophet Zechariah, son of his mentor and teacher Yehoyada, he encourages the people to kill Zechariah and shows no remorse or regret. According to Divrei HaYamim, as a result of these transgressions and Yehoash's lack of gratitude to his teacher and protector Yehoyada, he is first defeated in battle and ultimately assassinated. Our text, however, omits all of these interesting details that are seemingly very, very important. Why doesn't Sefer Melachim tell us of the downfall of Yehoash and what led to it? Both classic and modern commentaries grapple with this problem, and there is no especially compelling solution to be found. I would like to suggest a possibility. I'd like to argue that Sefer Melachim, in its own framework and way, does tell us what we need to know about King Yehoash's failings. On what basis do I believe that Sefer Melachim actually says what it apparently doesn't say? Well, throughout the entire book, we notice a pattern in its evaluation and assessment of the kings of their respective kingdoms. The monarchs of Israel are consistently judged with reference to the sins of Yerovam, namely, whether or not they've removed the illicit altars and golden calves that were installed by Yerovam to prevent his subjects from pining for the Beit HaMikdash and defecting to the kingdom of Yehuda. The monarchs of Yehuda, by contrast, are always judged with reference to whether they removed the bamot, or unauthorized personal altars, that were built by individuals throughout the land. In other words, the kings described in Sefer Melachim are ultimately measured based upon one standard, their relationship to the holy temple, the Beit HaMikdash, and its centrality. Did they take the unpopular but religiously correct path and eliminate institutions that competed with or diminished the prominence of the temple? Or did they succumb to pressure, allowing the status quo to remain, and sacrifice basically the supreme importance of the temple and the role that it was supposed to have in the life of the nation? With this in mind, we can now see that the essential flaw of Yehoash is in fact made clear from the outset. Despite his devotion to the temple and all he invested in renovating it, he didn't have the courage or integrity to stand up against the special interests and to dismantle the unauthorized personal sites of worship. In a way, for someone who took the Beit HaMikdash as seriously as Yehoash did, this was an even more tragic failure than it might have been for other kings who were less attuned to its significance. There is poetic justice in the fact that Yoash had to part with the treasures of the temple to placate Hazael. Symbolically, it demonstrates that all of his labors for the Beit HaMikdash were futile, as long as he didn't insist on its exclusivity as the location for divine worship. Yoash did much good, but at the end of the day, he put popularity ahead of principle, and was therefore relieved of his position in a dishonorable way. Divrei HaYamim fleshes out exactly how this limitation of Yoash expressed itself, first in his capitulating to the desire of the powerful and influential officers to reinstate some pagan worship, just as Shlomo, his role model, capitulated to the pressure from his wives, and then in his willingness to agree to the murder of a prophet whose only sin was confronting and humiliating him in the very temple he had once cherished.